Or not at all, and they're also preparing any meals that they can find, and they're also responsible for finding those meals. So the billionaires aren't working harder. It's because of the circumstances of the pandemic that they've been able to make a lot of money. And so we really need to think about that. When we have right now in East Africa, there is a humanitarian assistance, it's about $4.4 billion, but we only have 3% of the funding. We have funding going to Ukraine, but not to places like East Africa. And in terms of extreme hunger, you know, there is a classification that looks at malnutrition. It looks at water that's available in houses. It looks at how many meals people eat a day. So there's all these factors that it looks at, and it determines where it is. Is it extreme hunger? Is it famine? And it's called IPC 12345. And right now in East Africa, we are in 3, 4, and 5, and 5 is famine. So those are the emergency categories based on people's access to food, based on availability of clean water, and based on the number of calories they're able to take in a day.
Well, Shannon Scribner, we thank you for being with us, leading Oxfam America's humanitarian work. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Felsmeitberg, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Teresena, Tammy Warrenoff, Camille Baker, Tarina Nadura, Sam Alkofte, Maria Studio, John Hamilton, Rabbi Karen, Hani Massoud. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Stay safe.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The Engineering Committee meets on the first Thursday of the month at 7 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
KBOO Community Radio is looking for a full-charge bookkeeper. Do you have accounting and administrative experience? Do you enjoy working in a highly collaborative team environment? Are you looking for a workplace with a mission? Or do you know someone who is? Go to kboo.fm to learn more about the essential functions of the full-charge bookkeeper and the qualifications we are looking for. To apply, please email your resume and cover letter to hiring@kboo.org by Sunday, June 12th at midnight. You can also apply by mailing your resume and cover letter to KBOO Radio, 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. KBOO's financial health is our focus. Help us foster it.
Welcome to Sojourner Truth. Thank you for staying with us. This is your host, Margaret Prescott. Today, we bring you a special on Black and Palestinian solidarity in the face of global systemic racism. In 2019, U.S. police killed 1,099 people, according to Mapping Police Violence, which reports that 24% of those murdered were Black. Between 2013 and 2019, police killed a total of 7,666 people. Overall, Black people are three times more likely to be killed by police than white people. Other people of color, Indigenous people, and Latinx people are also killed at a much higher percentage than white people. Meanwhile, the United States currently has the largest incarcerated population in the world, with about 2.3 million people in jails and prisons across the country, this according to the Prison Policy Initiative. Meanwhile, in occupied Palestine, thousands have been killed or injured resisting Israeli occupation, and also as a result of poverty and destitution. Israeli police have been arresting and jailing Palestinian activists who resist state-sponsored violence and land grabs. During today's show, you will hear an in-depth discussion from a recent webinar entitled Abolition and Liberation on the connections between demands from the Movement for Black Lives to defund the police and abolish the prison industrial complex and Palestinian calls to tear down Israel's apartheid walls and free Palestine. These speakers bring years of on-the-ground experience and strategic thinking to the conversation. Angela Davis has been an activist and a scholar since the 1960s. Her 2003 book, Are Prisons Obsolete?, laid the strategic groundwork for the current abolition movement, as did the first Critical Resistance Conference, which she organized in 1998. She is joined from Palestine by Jamal Juma, a leading grassroots organizer since Palestine's first intifada in 1987, a founding member of the Palestinian Agricultural Relief Committee's Palestine National BDS Committee, the Palestine Association for Cultural Exchange, and Palestinian Environmental NGO Network. Juma is coordinator of the Palestinian Grassroots Anti-Apartheid Wall Campaign and Stop the Wall. Kristen Davis Bailey, who moderates their conversation, is a co-founder of Blacks for Palestine and a co-author of the 2015 Black Solidarity with Palestine statement signed by more than 1,000 Black people. He was a member of Black Youth Project 100 and Students for Justice in Palestine. Christian currently works at Palestine Legal and is a member of Left Roots. We live in a global world. We're all interrelated. So on Sojourner Truth, we work to bring directly to you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories that affect us all. And we draw out how those of us most impacted, women, communities of color, and other communities are responding. We also discuss the interrelationship between art and politics. Now for our news headlines.
For Pacifica Radio, I'm Christina Onnested. The United Nations says the death toll in Ukraine is thousands higher than the official figures. The head of the United Nations Human Rights Monitoring Mission in Ukraine, Matilda Bogner, says most of the deaths have been by explosive weapons with a wide impact area, such as missiles and airstrikes. She says they're also investigating credible allegations of torture and executions by Ukrainian forces against Russian soldiers and affiliated groups invading the country. Speaking before the European Union, French President Emmanuel Macron urged continued support of Ukraine against Russia's invasion.
L'Ukraine aujourd'hui se bat bien pour cela.
Ukraine is taking all the risks. Therefore, we have to build a new political, not just a legal form, the Council of Europe together with the Human Rights Court, which has been shaken up by Russia. But we have to find a political form that makes it possible to keep these values in Europe and to have political coordination with solidarity in terms of security, without doubt. Not the same thing as NATO, but cooperation and solidarity. Cooperation in terms of energy, integration, solidarity within Europe, energy solidarity, in order to be able to move forward together with infrastructure and connections.
The U.S. is also continuing its support
President Joe Biden has signed legislation aimed at speeding up weapons shipments to Ukraine in its fight against Russia. The Lend-Lease Act is modeled on a World War II program used to rush arms to European allies in the war against Hitler's Germany. Christopher Martinez reports.
So far, the U.S. is the largest military supplier of Ukraine, to the tune of $3.8 billion. The shipments of Javelin anti-tank missiles, for one example, have eaten up about a third of U.S. stockpiles. But that is not the only cost of war.
The cost of the fight is not cheap, but caving to aggression is even more costly. That's why we're staying in this.
Weapons shipments to Ukraine have ramped up as the war has moved to a new stage, marked by long-range artillery warfare in the eastern Donbas region. In the last 24 hours, Ukraine has received 13 weapons deliveries from seven nations. But the U.S. pipeline is running out unless Congress acts to authorize yet more money in a supplemental budget request. John Kirby is a spokesperson for the Pentagon.
We think with what we got left, that'll get us through most of this month.
Reporting for Pacifica Radio News KPFA, I'm Christopher Martinez.
Ukrainian officials say Russian troops are pounding away at the vital port of Odessa, apparently as part of efforts to disrupt the supply lines and weapon shipments that have been critical to Kiev's defense. The United Nations Human Rights Council will hold a special session this week following a request from Ukraine to discuss the worsening human rights situation in the country. Actions continue in the U.S. in opposition to the leaked Supreme Court draft opinion that overturns the landmark abortion rights ruling Roe v. Wade. Protesters last night held a march and rally outside author of the draft opinion, Justice Samuel Alito's home. Chanting abort the court, activists also addressed the right-wing criticism that protesting outside justices' homes is an invasion of their privacy. They spoke to journalist Chuck Modi.
Putting his hands in our uteruses. We are here to tell him he does not get to be safe and feel comfortable if we don't.
I don't think this comes anywhere near the level of intrusion that he is proposing.
I'm not being polite. I'm going to be loud and boisterous, and I'm going down with a fight.
Judges should leave us alone, and then we'll leave them alone. That's the end of the story.
New York Democrat Senate Leader Chuck Schumer says the Senate will vote on codifying women's access to abortion this week. The U.S. is calling an emergency meeting of the U.N. Security Council Wednesday following North Korea's latest test of a ballistic missile that was likely fired from a submarine. The launch Saturday was another sign of North Korea's leader Kim Jong-un carrying out his recent vow to speed up development of nuclear weapons. North Korea has fired 15 missiles so far this year. South Korea's new president says he'll present an audacious plan to improve North Korea's economy if it denuclearizes. Yoon Suk-yeol made the offer during a speech at his inauguration ceremony in Seoul today. He says the door to dialogue will be open to resolve North Korea's nuclear threat. He also said his government would be ready to work with the international community to present a plan to significantly strengthen North Korea's economy and improve its civilians' livelihoods. North Korea has previously rejected similar offers to provide incentives linked to progress in its denuclearization. The namesake son of late dictator Ferdinand Marcos appears to have been elected Philippines president in an astonishing reversal of the 1986 People Power Revolt that ousted his father. Marcos Jr. had more than 30.8 million votes in unofficial results. His nearest challenger, Vice President Lenny Robredo, had 14.7 million, with most of the votes tabulated from Monday's election. I'm Christina Onnestad, reporting for Pacifica Radio.
And those were our news headlines. This is your host, Margaret Prescott. We now kick off a special on Black and Palestinian solidarity in the face of global systemic racism. You will hear an in-depth discussion from a recent webinar entitled Abolition and Liberation, featuring Angela Davis, Jamal Juma, and Christian Davis Bailey. Let's hear from them now.
Thank you, everybody, for joining us today. It's really incredibly exciting how many people are interested in this conversation about abolition and liberation for Black folks, for Palestinians, and for the world. So to those of you who are entering these conversations either on Palestine or on abolition for the first time, we welcome you and invite you into our conversation and into our work for freedom and justice. And for those of you who are old friends and used to these conversations, we also are happy to have you with us as well. I'd like to first extend a welcome and thank you to our comrade Jamal joining us from Palestine and Dr. Angela Davis. It is an honor to be part of this conversation with you as somebody who has really just blazed trails for us in terms of thinking about prisons and abolition and thinking about transnational solidarity and thinking about the connections between the Black movement and the Palestinian struggle. We are very, very happy to have you with us here today. Thank you for joining. So I'd like to just open up to you first, Angela, any opening thoughts that you have, but also to get your answer to the question, what time is it on the clock of the world for us here in the Black struggle for the world more broadly?
Well, first of all, good morning or good evening in Palestine. I'd really like to thank all of the sponsors, co-sponsors of this amazing event, World Without Walls, Middle East Children's Alliance, and it's wonderful to finally meet you, Christian. I've been following your work for many years now, it seems, I guess, since you were a student at Stanford, right? Well, and thank you again for evoking Grace Lee Boggs. She is someone whose legacy we really have to hold on to, particularly during this period. And, you know, I would say that it's very important in attempting to understand where we are now to accustom ourselves to thinking more regionally and globally, that we Black people here in the United States are connected to Black struggles all over the Americas. As we engage in discussions about political developments in the US and struggles against racism spearheaded by Black people, it's so important to acknowledge that the United States of America is not the only place in this region where Black people have been struggling for justice. We follow in the path that was carved out by the Haitian Revolution, by struggles all over the Caribbean and Brazil and Uruguay. And then, of course, we focus very specifically this morning on the relationship between struggles in Palestine and Black struggles in the U.S. But regarding the question, what time is it? I think that it, may I take a couple of minutes? Okay. That we should think about this moment as a conjuncture. I like Stuart Hall's conjunctural analysis. And it's a conjuncture of various processes. First of all, the impact of the COVID-19 pandemic, which revealed the extent to which indigenous, Black, and Latinx communities have been overexposed to the virus due to structural factors, including the racism of the healthcare system and the resulting pre-existing conditions among people of color. And precisely at a time when increasing numbers of people were recognizing that racism acquires its apparent permanence, not because of individual attitudes, but because of economic and political and social structures. Precisely at that moment, we were presented with dramatic and indeed lethal examples of racism embedded in the structures of policing. Of course, Breonna Taylor, George Floyd, racist police violence has always been accompanied by racist vigilante violence. And of course, we've seen aside from the case of Ahmaud Arbery, we've seen other examples of that, most recently in Kenosha. Now, the third factor, which I think is perhaps the most important that we often underestimate, is the ongoing grassroots community organizing over the years. And of course, Grace Lee Boggs participated in that. And this included an extraordinary intellectual and cultural and labor investment over years and even over decades. And I think this was the determining factor. This is what made it possible to respond immediately to this convergence. And in this context, I wouldn't discount the work of musicians and filmmakers and other visual artists, and of course, the leadership in the sports community. And then finally, let me say that the anti-racist, anti-capitalist internationalists, and especially the pro-Palestinian stance and the feminist dimension as well of our organizing over the years have been particularly important. And this has led to an increasing popularity of abolitionist analyses over the last 20 years, all of which is to say, you know, what time is it? It's a moment of hope, not only for Black people and communities of color in the U.S. And Palestine, but all over the world.
So Jamal, I present a similar question to you. What time is it on the clock of the world in Palestine? And maybe in addition to that, for folks who are for the first time learning of Palestine or getting familiar with the context, in a nutshell, what is the essence of the struggle for freedom in Palestine?
Thank you, Christian. Thank you, Christian, and all other comrades on the organizing this. And it's my honor also to be with Dr. with Angela Davis and this panel as well. First of all, Yanni, good morning to you, comrades, and good evening to the Palestinians, to Palestine here. In terms of what we are facing now and what we are at now, we are dealing with the Trump, what's so-called deal of the century, what we call the steal of the century. In fact, Yanni, since 2017, when Trump came to the power, they start like the joint Israeli-American plan to liquidate the Palestine issue. And they get it in steps seriously, from recognizing Jerusalem as a capital of Israel, to targeting the right of return for the Palestinians, refugees, to recognize the sovereignty of Israel on the Golan Heights, then to the recognizing the colonies and the settlements in the West Bank. That's end up with what's so-called the annexation plan of the West Bank, which is in fact a part of the plan of Trump that has been maybe a little bit, the announcement itself has been delayed, but on the ground they are going fastly into this annexation practically by organizing and building a new colonies in the West Bank, but we call it outposts near the Palestinian groves and Bedouin communities, as they targeted the Jordan Valley to be evacuated and annexed to Israel, the apartheid state. This came at the same time, which is a part of the plan, what they are trying to organize in the Middle East, the normalization with the Emirates, which is, I think, it started from Washington, which is reorganizing the whole Middle East, in fact, like to be led by Israel, to be the police of the Americans in the Middle East. And the one who is paying the price for this will pay the price is the Palestinians. Because now the serious talks within the Palestinian political regime, what we can do. Clearly, we are living in a moment like where, when the last days of Yasser Arafat, where clearly that there's a plans coming to the area where they with Arafat disappear, or they killed Yasser Arafat, in fact. So now the authority or the Palestinian leadership is expecting same things going on, especially with this Emirates, Israeli new normalization. That's clearly it will be followed by other Arab collaborated country that followed the angle of the American Israel in the Middle East. So the options that they offer, they were discussing, in fact, whether to go to the United Nations and to tell them, okay, this is Palestine cause, and we don't know that, you are in a way or another responsible over the Palestinian people, which is in fact, as we see it as a Palestinian, it's a wrong option. The other option that they are discussing is the handing what, as they call, the keys to Israel, meaning that call the occupation back again to the West Bank, which is in fact also another wrong choice. What we say as a popular movement is the Palestinian Authority and the Palestinian leadership, in fact, they didn't get to the right solution, the right choice, which is the people, the revolution, the intifada, That's what should be happened. But there is a gap between the people and this, and our, unfortunately, our leadership at the moment. That doesn't mean that we are like waiting. Every day the struggle is going in the drama. Every day the people demonstration. Every day they are arresting people, confiscating the land. People go into the streets. More villages joining the struggle. So the struggle is going on. And here I would go like and say that what we are facing today is a accumulation of over a century of settler colonialism. That's our issue. That's our deep issue as a Palestinians. It is a European imperialist project, colonial project in the Middle East, which started with, they based it in Palestine itself to keep the fragmentation of the Middle East after the First World War. And we are the Palestinians who's paying this very heavy price. So since then, the British has been promised the Zionist movement, a homeland in Palestine, that start bringing waves of immigrants to Palestine, settling them on the Palestinian lands. That's ended up in 1948, what we call the Nakba, where 72 of our historical Palestine has been occupied. 85% of our people there has been wiped out, like has been ethnically cleansed from their land. Most of their villages and cities has been destroyed, leveled to the ground, 530 villages. 90% of the Palestinian land has been confiscated and transferred to what's so-called Jewish National Fund, which is like one of the biggest robbery funds that taking the Palestinian lands and distributing it to the new settlers. But since then, since that time, the Palestinians never stopped their resistance. What's our goals over there? What do we want as a Palestinians? Simply, we want like any other people under occupation, lost their freedom. We are struggling for self-determination, for freedom, for the right of return for our people. That over 60% of our people are living in the diaspora and in the refugee camps. So this is our main, and against colonialism, racism, and apartheid that has been formed from the beginning. Israel, since it has been established in 1948, it was an apartheid state, and it has been established as the model of the South African that time, building with the supremacy of the European settlers over the indigenous of the, in the Palestinian struggle. Why the Palestinians didn't give up until now? The thing is about the connection of the Palestinians with the land. How deep this people is connected. If you go to any refugee camp in Lebanon, Syria, if you go to any Palestinian in the diaspora that is living since 70 years there, educated their kids and their families, generations, and they draw a map in their minds of their land, the number of the trees, how much dunams. So it has been connected deeply in there. We read our history through and of ancestors also through the land, through the stones there, through the age of the olive trees, that some of them goes back to 1,000 years or more. This connection maybe it has been translated with some stories to us, like any that we are facing in the ground, where like in one case, like any the soldiers, when they built the wall, they were coming to a family there, and they destroy part of a house of a farmer there, and also he has small nursery there. They destroy it, and they want to destroy the house. And the man was putting his head on the ground, and the soldiers was like astonished and was surprised. What are you doing? Are you get crazy? Are you fall unconscious? He told them, No. I'm just listening to what the land talked to me. So they start laughing. Are you crazy? No, he said, exactly. You are the crazy. You don't know this relation. The land told me, don't worry. As much as you are deeply rooted in me, nobody can uproot you. So he start laughing at them. Do whatever they want. You do whatever you want. So this is the secret of the connection that the people have. The same with the Bedouin communities in the Jordan Valley, the villages that they had been targeted daily by confiscating land. Many had been killed when they are going to pick their olives and to deal with their land. So this is what can I describe about this? So, and this is the critical moments that our struggle is a survival. We are standing up, and what, as Angela ends, I think it's a moment of hope. We never lost the hope. The hope is always there. And why we are continue? Because we always have the hope. We never gave up the hope.
Thank you, Jamal. And I'm glad that you and we each have some degree of hope, because it is a moment that can feel very full of despair. But it is only this shred of hope that kind of keeps our movements moving forward. So whatever we can do to cultivate that, we all need to be doing that. And just to speak a moment on the similarities I see between our conditions and structures, what we're dealing with as Black folks and as Palestinians is living under colonialism, of having outside forces decide that they either want our land or control of our bodies and our labor, and will utilize their own power and domination to maintain that. So in a very kind of similar process to how the United States pushed indigenous people off of their land over 400 years, that's what Israel is doing to the indigenous Palestinians, who are also experiencing or falling under a system of racism and apartheid. So we'll speak more about these connections as we go through forward, but I just wanted to kind of bring that in. So I want to turn to just the conditions of prison or the prison industrial complex in the United States. I'll be reading just a quick quote from our comrade George Jackson, who was one of the most brilliant revolutionaries and martyrs of our struggle, who was killed in a prison uprising in 1971. But he writes while he's in prison, "The masses must be taught to understand the true function of prisons. Why do they exist in such numbers? What is the real underlying economic motive of crime and the official definition of types of offenders or victims? The people must learn that when one offends the totalitarian state, it is patently not an offense against the people of that state, but an assault upon the privilege of the privileged few." And so just with this in mind, this question of what is the function of the prison in our society, I'd like to turn to you, Angela, to just give us an overview of the prison industrial complex.
Well, you know, first of all, thank you, Jamal, for that analysis. And thank you, Kristen, for evoking George Jackson. His work reminds us that the analysis and theories with which we work today emerged from prison intellectuals. You know, there is a field that we call critical prison studies, that university field, an academic field, that would not have been possible without the contributions of people in prison, people like George. Police and prisons provide us with dramatic legacies of settler colonialism, slavery, and capitalism. And of course, many of us understand that police and prisons have never been designed to protect and serve all of the people, but in a class society, in a society that thrives on racism and heteropatriarchy, it is clear that police and prisons are designed to maintain the status quo. And it seems as if we've continued over the years, over decades, over centuries to try to make these institutions more democratic, to try to make them serve everyone. But they are structurally biased. They are precisely designed to protect affluent, mostly white people. And this will not change no matter how much we tinker with these institutions. And I think that the connection with Palestine, the emergence of a powerful Palestine solidarity movement has helped our movements in this country to mature, to develop deeper and more complex analyses. It has given us the courage to be more upfront about abolitionist approaches. And specifically recognizing the ties between the Israeli military and U.S. police departments helped us to understand that we couldn't simply call for the prosecution of individual police officers, but rather that we we needed to begin to challenge the very structures of policing, including the militarization of the police, emanating in part from the impact of the Israeli influence. In other words, our analysis not only had to account for one might say genealogies of prisoning in the U.S. that take us back to the violent usurpation of indigenous land and the violent control of forced African labor, but also recognizing the part racial capitalism has played in policing and incarceration. And because racism is never static, never unchanging, contemporary racism, whether directed against Black communities or Latinx and indigenous communities or Asian communities, this contemporary racism incorporates and builds on global Islamophobia. And Palestine solidarity has taught us precisely about the importance of a more complicated understanding of policing and imprisonment and the importance of anti-imperialist approaches. Let me just say that, as I made this point before, that we keep trying to make these institutions more democratic. We keep trying to guarantee that everyone will receive equal treatment, but they are structurally biased. And for people who think that the police can be reformed, the question needs to be posed: why do we keep experiencing the same thing over and over? Why could the police in Kenosha not restrain themselves from shooting Jacob Blake 7 times, even though they must have certainly known that the world would be watching? In a sense, you might say, they see policing as keeping the world safe from Black people. And looking at Palestine, it makes no sense to argue that all we have to do is say, just reform the Israeli army, reform the Israeli military police. That makes no sense in that context. And I think we are learning that the same thing applies to the United States.
This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. We're going to take a quick station break. When we return, you will hear more from our special Abolition and Liberation. Please stay with us. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Sojourner Truth. Check us out on our website at sotrueradio.org. And if you're a member of Facebook, you can look for us and like us there. We're also nationwide and worldwide on SoundCloud. You can go to the search bar and type in Sojourner Truth with Margaret Prescott to find us. And today, I'd like to give a shout out to our SoundCloud listeners in Covina in Southern California, and internationally, a shout out to our SoundCloud listeners in Israel.
So Jamal, I'd like to turn to you and to understand, just some people, they might look at the occupation and say, oh, well, it kind of makes sense. Like the Israelis, they need to like take care of themselves and protect their security. Can you talk us through why that's not actually the case of what the situation is?
And just I want to thanks first for Angela for the analysis about the prisons. Something especially about the Palestine, when we talk about the prisons, is like to destroy the Palestinian resistance. And this has been in fact used systematically in different ways. The actual prisons, we have since 1967 until now over 1 million Palestinian imprisoned since that time. We are talking about a population, total population of 5 million. So 1/5 of the population. You don't find even a house that there is no prisoner from the house was in the prison. But even go beyond that, it's not just imprisoning individual, but imprisoning also the communities by itself. Like Gaza, how you describe Gaza? Gaza is the biggest open prison, air prison in the world. The same how they fragment the Palestinian people and prison them. Jerusalem today is encircled by 181 kilometers of walls. The West Bank now it's creating with this apartheid system and a prison. North ghetto, middle, south, so many enclaves around. It's also prison, fragment the people to kill them, to kill their resistance. The other thing that they were targeting also is killing the resistance inside the people by the prisons through generations. And here, I would say that this started even practically in the last 10 years, where they targeted the children. In Silwan, one community, in 1 year, they arrested 1,000 child. We're talking about from 8 years old until 16 years old. Taking them to jail, harassed them, tortured them, terrifying them, released them after 2 weeks and chasing them at home. Keep attacking their homes, asking about them, to destroy a generation, in fact. And this has been used in Hebron as well and several other places. If you talk about defending themselves, who's defending himself here? Who's the one under attack? Who's the one who needs protection? Is it the settlers in the West Bank, that there is over 60,000 settler militarized, armed, and trained, and they are attacking Palestinians, killing them, shooting the farmers, burning the mosques, burning the cars, and this. Who is the Palestinians? All what they are doing is defending themselves. When the Palestinians go out in the streets, they go out against house demolition. They go out to defend their existence, their communities. So this is the way that they are trying to use to criminalize the Palestinians. We are the poor, we are what to defend ourselves. In fact, we are the one who's defending and they are the one who's attacking. And if you look at the history, when you talk about Palestinians now not controlling more than 13% of their homeland, indigenous homeland. So we are the unsystematic attack of ethnic cleansing, which goes along with massacres that happen systematically against the communities, against Gaza, against refugee camps, against the communities in the West Bank in the last 25 years. So what we have to reverse this work. So the Palestinians are the one who need protection, the Palestinians who are defending themselves and defending this life and the future, in fact, and their next generations to live normally like any other people in the world.
Thank you, Jamal. And I really appreciate just your point that it's Palestinians who are defending themselves and who are being attacked. My first time in Palestine was in 2013, and we were going around to different places. We saw the wall, we saw settlements, we saw the checkpoint, and in every case, people would ask, what possible justification do the Israelis have for mistreating you in this way? Because it's for their security. Well, 2013, this was the same year that Trayvon Martin was killed by somebody who claimed that he needed to stand his ground to protect his security from a 17-year-old boy. These logics of security tend to focus on security for one group of people, a group of people who tend to be kind of oppressing us, and completely ignore security for our own sake. So I really appreciate you for bringing that in to the conversation.
When we're talking about Black Palestinian solidarity, that solidarity is grounded in part on the historical struggles of both peoples and the fact that there has been this consistent history of struggle, even against all odds. Palestinians have been inspired by Black struggles. Black struggles have been inspired and assisted by Palestinians. And I think that those of us who've been involved in abolitionist, prison abolitionist movements have understood much more clearly, because we have looked at the situation in Palestine, that prisons are not discrete institutions, that they are a part of a continuum of carcerality that often spreads into the community. And of course, in occupied Palestine, and Jamal made the point that Gaza is the largest open air prison in the world. We see the continuum of carcerality that spreads into the communities. We see checkpoints, we see the overt presence of military police. And from this, we have learned in the U.S. that we need not only to challenge prisons as discrete institutions, but we have to stand up against electronic bracelets, against house arrests, and all of the other forms of carcerality that are frequently represented as alternatives to incarceration. Maya Shenhua and Victoria Law's most recent book, Prison by Any Other Name, explores, you know, all of those repressive methods that we see in Palestine that are often represented as reforms, but actually serve to broaden and extend and deepen the impact of carcerality on our society.
Can I ask you to say more about that and talk about why prison reform is not the answer to this issue?
Well, the history of the institution of the prison is a history of reform. Prisons were introduced as a reform, and throughout the history of the institutions, there have been those who have argued that we can make this a better, more humane, more democratic institution. But each time these reforms are instituted, the institution, the prison, becomes more deeply rooted on the social, political, economic landscape of the country. And I think it's important to point out that it was the United States of America that was the site of the original argument that prisons should serve as the most effective effort to address harm in our community. And in a sense, it was through colonialism, et cetera, this institution gets introduced to the world. It's and just as we ought to accustom ourselves to remembering that capitalism is a historical phenomenon. It came into being through history. It is not a permanent aspect of human life on the planet. We can move beyond capitalism. We can overthrow capitalism. The same thing applies to the institution of the prison. We can develop new and more effective ways of addressing harm in our community. Our system of so-called justice does not have to be grounded in racist repression. And so therefore, it gives us the opportunity to think about how it is we can really keep our community safe. What do we need to keep our community safe? We need jobs, we need housing, we need education, and all of those issues that are often marginalized when we simply talk about prison reform. We don't want to remain within the footprint of that institution. We want to radically reorganize society in such a way that does not mean that we will require prisons in the future. And Palestine has been a great inspiration in the development of these ideas.
Thank you.
I think it's about...
go ahead.
I think it's about removing this oppression systems, like this racism, this apartheid systems. That's the solution. That's where we have to go up to. This is the demand should be. And if this is like not racist, we will have, as a Palestinians, we will have much better life, the same as the black. I mean, what Angela was talking about, from all these needs to these communities to be safe, is all these needs that they need, from education, from health, from medical treatment. So that's where the point. And this is very connected to the capitalism, to the imperialism, which has been go over not just Palestine and the United States, but over so many countries around the world. I think what we are facing is not occupation. It's settler colonialism. It's targeting the existence of the people. And here, if you want the Palestinian freedom, you have to end up the cause, which is the Zionism as a colonial ideology. This is the one that can bring real peace to the Middle East and to the Palestinians particularly, and to the Israelis, to be honest. If they have been liberated from the Zionist colonial ideology, this will bring them down to think of the others, of the Palestinians, as a people, and we can start talking about equality and about reform again. So it is mostly about this, and this is what we need to describe. Occupation is not the right word for what we are facing in Palestine today.
Freedom is not a discrete point in history. I think freedom is a process. And abolition helps us to understand discrete issues such as policing and incarceration and within a more holistic context. So we see police and prisons as the most public face of state violence, whether here in the U.S. or in Palestine. And I think that in both instances, we are referring to radical social, political, economic transformation. We are referring to processes. And I think that Jamal, in pointing out that the end to the occupation will not necessarily bring about freedom. There are more substantive goals that will be necessary in order to carve out the influences of settler colonialism, of militarism, and of course to move beyond capitalism. But let me say that I think feminism plays an important role here, and this is something that I don't think we've yet mentioned in the conversation, have we?
Mm-hmm. We're here now.
Okay, so I think that when we speak about abolition, we're actually talking about a feminist approach to abolition, or what some of us have called abolition feminism. Beth Ritchie, Erica Miners, Gina Dent, and I are trying to finish a book, a collaborative book that is called Abolition Feminism Now. And so the argument there is that we have to think holistically. We have to think about radical transformations to the society, which will be a process. We have to recognize that feminism is not simply about assimilating women into a context that does not change, just as anti-racism is not about bringing previously marginalized groups into structures and institutions that continue to do that work, but rather we have to talk about deep and expansive, radical transformations. And in my reflections on the nature of freedom, I have come to the conclusion that freedom is not an endpoint, that we will never reach the moment when we're able to say, oh, all struggles are now relegated to the past, but that we will constantly recognize new dimensions of freedom. And in Palestine, of course, the role of food justice is so important. The ways in which Palestinian land has been usurped, and now the effort to annex so much of the small portion of Palestine that is now allocated to people who have the historical claim to that land, that we'll be talking about food justice and animal issues, and you know, there are all kinds of ways in which we will probably be carrying on our struggle for freedom in the future.
I think we have, each of us as a people in different countries, they have a rich history of struggle. But until now, like, we didn't able to connect our struggles together and join it together actually on the ground. So I think this is the way where we can win. Maybe like South African, like any 25 years ago, win. But this is like, it is, and this their winning was for every one of us, for us as Palestinians, for African Americans, for all other people around the world. But how we can, the question is how we can really bring our struggle together, globalizing our struggle, connecting strongly our struggles together and build on it. This is the secret. This is where the movement has to work strongly on, and we have to understand that. If you look at the other side, what's happening now in the Middle East is a very good example. You know, this imperialism and colonialism, colonial countries, you know, they are hitting us deep in the heart. Now the main questions, do we have Arab Spring? Is it Arab Spring? But why it ended like this? It's not because it is not a revolution. It's not people standing up for their rights and they start going to the streets. But it's the fact that they were able to just destroy the people's revolutions. And now it's like we became doubted our struggles, whether it's right or not. Did we did it in the right way or not? But again, it's fragmented. It's not brought together. We didn't bring the lessons all together and support each other directly in the right way for each of our struggles. The same struggle you have there, we have it in Palestine, and they have it in Iraq, they have it in Afghanistan, they have it in Libya, in Syria, in Latin America, in Brazil now, in Colombia, and different several other places in the world. So the challenge for us all is how we can come together. Like, there is an attempt by the Palestinians, like in World Without Walls is one of an example, one of attempts that we were trying to do this connection. Hey guys, like, walls around the world is not just in Palestine. It's in 70 countries around the world in the same goals of oppression. So let's come together, like in Palestine, in United States, Mexico, in Latin America, in the favelas, in Iraq, in several other places, in Kashmir, and several other places where we are facing the same. This is the idea. This is what we have to build on. Boycott, divestment, and sanction is another plan. We should think of it for each and every struggle in the world. How we can punish, how we can make these criminals complicit.
Thank you, Jamal. And I think we are in this moment of bringing our struggles together. The last 6 years have also been a moment within our movements of elevating the struggles within our communities. So when I was in Black Youth Project 100, that was organizing from a Black queer feminist lens of understanding the need to elevate the struggles of women, gender nonconforming, queer and trans people against heteropatriarchy at the same time as we fight racism. And for those who follow my advice and read Angela Davis's work, you will see both in Are Prisons Obsolete and Freedom is a Constant Struggle, exactly how paying attention to the needs of these movements and struggles and parts of our community helps elevate freedom for everybody.
Yeah, but this doesn't mean that I am not recognizing and admiring all what we did as a people together. Like, but I think the moment needs much more. Like, we have to fasten this. It's like, there is a lot of things that we did together. We support each other in so many things, all over our history. In 1st of November to 1970, you gave a very strong statement in support of Palestinian struggle that time. So there is a history, there is a big history there. But we are in the moment that we're facing a very advanced imperialist ways of destroying our struggle. That's where we have to advance our connections and support together.
We're out of time. I'd like to thank all of the speakers featured on today's show, as well as Tristan Davis Bailey, for allowing us to share their audio with you. I would also like to thank the Sojourner Truth team, Romero Funes, our assistant producer, and today's audio engineer. Remember to visit our website at sotrueradio.org and follow us on Facebook, our handle on Twitter and Instagram at SoTrueRadio. Thank you so much for listening. This is your host, Margaret Prescott, and y'all, please stay safe. In order to fight the power can be.